We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Again, this part of Focus, we'll be talking about money management and financial planning. And we had as a special guest here in the first part of the show, along with David Sinnoh from the U of I College of Business, Mark Jukowski. He's in the mortgage business. He works at Wind Trust Mortgage in Champaign, has been in that business for 18 years. Before that was a realtor. And Dave Sinnoh brought Mark along just because he thought people would have questions about mortgages. And we were just going to do that for the first hour. And then he said, well, you know, if you want me to hang around for a little bit here, I can. And we said, sure. So again, I want to make sure people who are listening, you have mortgage-related questions, they're welcome. Of course, anything that has to do with financial planning, the usual thing that we do here with Dave, that's welcome too. Before we get going here, though, we would welcome people to make a pledge because that's really what we're one of the big things that we're all about here. This is our fall pledge period. It's one of the times we try to remind people just how important their financial support is and invite people to do that. And for us, this is one of the best ways we have of getting new folks in. And one of the goals that we've set for this drive is 300 new friends. So that's people who have not supported us before. Maybe you've been listening for a while. And now is the first time you can make a contribution. Well, that'd be a great time to do it, and it's real easy. You can call. You can go online. Martha Deal, one of our producers here in studio with me. So what do people need to do now?
Well, people need to pick up the phone and call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org, or they can put a check in the mail to us here at WILL. They can call us, and we'll be glad to give them the address. You know, David, you started out saying financial planning. That's really what we're doing here in the Fund Drive. We're doing our financial planning to be able to figure out what programs will be able to be available to you in the future, and your dollars are a way of voting for the ones that you think are important. So pick up the phone, call 217-244-95 or go to willpledge.org, and we can certainly talk to you at that time about some of the appreciation gifts we have and hear what you have to say about the programs.
Okay. A little bit later on, maybe we can do a little update and tell people how we're doing. But the important thing is, you know, maybe you've been thinking about it, and I know you got plenty of other things to do. Why don't you put that on your to-do list, maybe even bump it up to the closer to the top, calling in with a contribution or going online. Or as Martha said, you just want to put a check in the mail. That would be great, too. Any way you do it, it's an investment in future programming here on WILL. Well, let me give our phone numbers again for calling into the program. They are the same as always, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the one that's the one for people who, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call. And either way, if you have questions, you have some more questions about mortgages, that's good. But any other kinds of questions about investing, money management, you can do that. Well, now, I think, Dave, maybe there were a couple of other things you thought might be good to talk about in regards to mortgages.
I did. I wanted to talk about the fact, you know, Congress brought to us cash for clunkers, and they also brought to us the $8,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers, but that apparently is going to expire on November 30th unless it is extended, and of course there is a lot of lobbying efforts to extend that $8,000 tax credit. But that brings up a different question, Mark, and that is, how long does it actually take, for example, from the time that I walk into your office and I'm reasonably prepared to actually closing on that loan? It strikes me there's, what, about 45 days left in this program. Is 45 days enough to meet this deadline?
Barely. Typically, in the past, it would take usually 30 days to process a loan. That's from the day you come in to verifying income, verifying your down payment, doing the appraisal, all those types of things. Typically, 30 days. Right now, because of the underwriters are very, very conservative, they are asking for things that I have never seen before.
What would be an example?
Verifying. I had one the other day. One of the ladies in my office had a customer, and the underwriter wanted to verify that the seller wanted a copy of their marriage certificate to verify that the seller, this is not the buyer, that the seller was the same person. In other words, the person had been divorced and remarried, but on the deed, on the title, it had a different name. What that has to do with the borrower, I don't know. But, I mean, things like that. They'll want to verify income that, you know, just they're just very, very, very picky, very, very, very conservative. And things that used to take 30 days easily are now taking 40 days, 45 days. They're afraid, David, that something's going to happen, that they're going to have to buy the loan back or the house is going to – or they're missing something that the that they'll come back on them later, or they'll miss their payment or be, you know, foreclosed on. So they are being meticulous, overkill. And that's what's – and so I'd say 45 days is more typical than 30. It comes up right to the time. And they try to do it quickly for purchases, but some of the things they ask for are – they're, you know, I've never seen before.
Right. So when I walk in, I eventually close a loan with Wintrust or ABC Mortgage Company. That document, that set of papers, then goes back to headquarters, but headquarters really doesn't hang on to that. That is resold back essentially to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, et cetera. So you're really in the processing business, if you will. You're really not into the holding business of long-term loans.
Correct.
Okay.
We have some callers, and let's talk with someone in Morton Grove. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, Dr. Sino.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if I could ask you a non-mortgage question.
Certainly can.
My question is this here. In consideration of a trip to Europe next year, I was wondering what my alternatives might be if I suspected the dollar was going to go down and the euro would go up. Is there some place I could put my money now with an eye towards the dollar weakening and the euro being stronger a year from now, and therefore I might have at least good purchasing power rather than a reduced purchasing power?
Well, one of the things that you can do is you actually can open up an account. You can open it up in a savings account in a euro-denominated savings account.
Uh-huh.
So there are financial institutions that will do that for you.
Okay.
If you feel strongly. Whatever you think you're going to spend, do half. That way you're either half right or half wrong.
Oh,
and that's it's sort of like selling a stock. When someone comes to me and says, Dave, I've got $50,000 of ABC stock. Should I sell it or should I hang on to it? And, of course, I, as you know, I'm not a stock picker, and what I tell people is to do half. That way you're at least half right. True, you'll be half wrong, but at least you'll be half right. That would be my advice.
Okay. I don't know if there – I hear talk about these ETFs and things like that. Does that make any sense to involve myself with placing some money with an ETF?
I don't think so. I think it's highly volatile. That's ETFs typically are either for very, very long-term investors or for traders. And in very short periods of time, ETFs can really get skewed because of the traders who are trading in and out of those ETFs. I don't think that's appropriate for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. It certainly tells me what I need to do and how I can hedge a little bit.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
We'll talk next with somebody in St. Charles, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm one of those people that took their time, put 20% down on my house, has got a good mortgage. I've refinanced mine a couple of times, so I've only got four more years on my house, so which is a good thing. The problem is, and I'm a contractor, and a lot of these houses that people bought, it was no money down. They didn't have any furniture in the house. They drive a beat up old car. I mean, they barely made their finances. And then they get hit with the property taxes. So, to me, I wonder what happened to the 20% down bit. I don't understand it. It's like if I have to bust my chops to get it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, why can't these people do this? We've got a glut of people on the market out there, a glut of houses. It's just insane. You can't buy or sell a house.
Well, you've raised a really good question about down payments. And I think it's worth, Mark, maybe going over the different programs that are currently available and the down payments that are actually required for those programs. I'm sympathizing with you. Obviously, the more money that is put down, the less risk for everyone in a deal, and especially for someone like yourself who went the right route, put the 20% down, worked hard. It's very, very exasperating to see people walk in and actually get 100% finance. So, Mark, is that day over? What are the down payment rules?
That day is over. Right now, for conventional mortgages, normally you're finding 5% being the minimum for conventional, and FHA can put down as little as 3.5%. What you're talking about with 100% loans, and I'll just be very brief on this, but this is my understanding of what happened. The Clintons, back in their time period, wanted to raise the home ownership percentage in the United States from 63% to 68%. So just a 5% increase. They wanted more people to own homes, which is a good idea. Well, how do you go about doing that? Well, the problem was that most people couldn't buy homes for two or three reasons. Number one was their credit. Number two was down payment. And those are the two major things. So the administrations went to the banks and said, well, we want to raise it 5%. Do it. Well, how do you do it? Well, there are several ways to do it. One is to lower the down payment requirements, and that's where the 100% loan things came into play. And it just got really out of hand. Basically, there was five or six things that caused this problem. Number one was the no down payment. That means the lender has all the risk. The borrower has none. The credit scores, they were down. You could get down to five. People made loans at 540, which, you know, why make a loan to someone who has historically shown you they're not going to pay you on time? So no down payment, low credit scores, did not require mortgage insurance, which would, if you're above 80%, that's just another – that insurance company insures the lender. If anything goes wrong, they'll participate in that loss with them. Didn't require that. Didn't require these people to pay their escrows. Didn't require to pay their tax, 1/12 of their taxes and insurance. Those are the worst people that will save for taxes and insurance. And then on top of all that, the worst thing was that they would not, a lot of them were adjustables, I should say, or adjustable rate mortgages with prepayment penalties, meaning if they pay it off in 2 years, if their credit went up and got better, they couldn't refinance without a penalty. But here's the worst part. They started these no-doc loans, meaning that you didn't have to verify what your income was. You just told them what your income was. Now, that – all those things added together caused what I consider, I mean, the major problem we've had. Those days are over. There's nobody out there. The lenders are pulling in. There's as far left, far liberal as it was before. It's just the opposite. It's just is that much conservative now. So there's nobody out there that's going to make a 100% loan anymore. There's going to be 20% down is what they prefer to see. They do 95% loans. They do 90s, but with mortgage insurance. But those days are over. You're not going to find anything like that. If they do, I mean, VA loans are still 100%. I take that back. VA loan is, but you have to pay a VA funding fee on top of it. That's the only exception to that, but there's a reason for that. So those days are pretty much over.
Can I offer one suggestion to people out there?
Yeah.
Well, to me, I started – the house I'm in now is my third house. I started up little – I bought something real small, real cheap, and – improved on it a little bit, and it went to the next size. It went to the next size. And the thing that I come across 100% of the time is that they want to have their dream house now instead of waiting for it. Nobody wants to wait anymore. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the biggest problem. You want to buy a $500,000 to $700,000 house without any kind of risk. It's kind of insane. You know, it's...
You're right.
You're stepping from the gas leader. You know, you're putting yourself into the fire, basically. And if people would just take and think, you know, patience to me... It took me 15 to 20 years to get where I'm at. It doesn't come overnight, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's all I could say to people. Just, you know, be savvy with your finances, because now you got to start thinking about putting stuff away for college. And if you got to be able to work the two out at the same time, and it's, you know, it's interesting trying to juggle stuff now, but thanks, guys. Appreciate
okay,
it.
We're not disagreeing with anything you're saying. In fact, you're sort of preaching to the choir.
Let me just ask one other question, because I think, you know, there are some people that say, in addition to all of the factors that you listed, Mark, that one of the problems was, or one of the contributing factors was, that the loan originators could make that loan and then pass it off to somebody else. And they didn't. And once the loan was made, and they made their money making the loan, then if that person couldn't pay, it wasn't their problem. It was somebody else's problem. And is there any way to put some of the responsibility for a loan going bad on the originator of the loan?
Well, in my opinion, I'm not sure about that, because the lenders are the ones that were the ones coming out with the programs, and there was not just one. There was 5, 6, 7, 8, I mean, there's hundreds of them. And basically, if one did it, someone else would do it. And, you know, it's just like FHA loans when they came out. The same thing was said about that. But, you know, the key thing, and I think, in my opinion, is talking to people, counseling that person. I mean, I had people that came in and, you know, with some of these programs, and simply I sat down there and told them, look, your credit score is low. You know, you need to work on it. Here's how you do it. You make your payments on time. That's first thing. You cut down on making, you know, doing this, doing that. Get your credit scores up to the level where you can do this. Put money in your savings accounts for your taxes and your insurance if you decide not to escrow. You know, do all those types of things. You know, those programs are available. Believe me, everybody's here. It spreads like wildfire. And, you know, everybody heard about them. Everybody was calling about them. If you don't do it, someone else is gonna do it. The lenders were the companies that came out with these programs. You know, they were making money hand over fist. And they knew, they had to know, that eventually it was going to catch up with them. So the loan originator is, you know, was involved in it, yes. But if one person did it, no one would. I mean, they were out there, mm-hmm. and they were being courted by lenders, and it was what it was, and it was legal, and it was, I mean, at that time it was the thing to do. You have to counsel the person, and I did all the time, and that's the part I think was missing in some of the people. They didn't tell them it was an adjustable rate mortgage. Gosh, you have to tell them that. You have to tell them what's going to happen. You have to prepare them what's going to happen down the road. I don't buy what people said sometimes. You hear, I didn't know it was an adjustable rate mortgage. When you go to the closing, you know, when you close that loan, there are probably 3, 4, 5, 6 places where it says it's an adjustable rate mortgage. Here's how it adjusts. It's an adjustable rate mortgage. Here's what your payment could be. It's an adjustable rate mortgage. And if you don't know that, you know, I don't know what to say. But
and many of these subprime mortgages were not standard adjustable rate mortgages.
No.
When we think of an ARM today, whether it's a 2-1, a 3-1, or a 5-1 ARM, generally, when you have an adjustable rate mortgage, conventionally, the maximum interest rate increase in any given year is 2%.
Mm-hmm.
2%. But on some of these subprimes were not conventionally written, you could start with a teaser rate of 2 or 3% and find yourself with a 10 or 12 or 15% rate down the road. Impossible to pay.
Right.
Impossible to pay. And don't forget that during the period from about 2000 to 2006, when we were really generating most of these mortgages, the country was awash in cheap money. And when cheap money is washing around, it's going to look for a place to roost. And it's going to be chasing and taking on more risk when there's lots and lots of money awash in the system, as was the case. Mm-hmm. And that also exacerbated the problem, along with a general feeling in the country, whether you were a Democrat or a Republican or liberal or conservative, that home ownership was a good idea for more people. And that sort of drove, as you pointed out, this whole underwriting unraveling, where the underwriting standards were tremendously liberalized, leading to all of these issues.
Okay. Well, we got some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana, and that's line 2. Hello.
Hi. I think Dave just hit at the point I was going to make, and that is that most of these loans that went bad, it seems to me, were written in probably about the year 2002 to 2006.
Correct.
In the wave. And that it's not really a political issue. If anybody, you're going to blame anybody, I wouldn't blame a president. You'd blame Alan Greenspan for the loose money policies that Dave was talking about. But I think when you get into the fact that the whole system was bad. It was mentioned that the mortgage underwriters didn't worry about this because they weren't going to end up with the final responsibility. They were going to sell it to a greater fool. And the greater fool theory prevailed until finally you end up with somebody who has no clue what's going on, who pays way too much for a product, and he can't do anything with it, and the product turns bad, and it's true whether it's an overpriced stock or it's true if it's an overpriced tulip or whatever it is. The greater fool theory and these crazy bubbles always is the one, and the guy at the end always is the guy who ends up holding the kitty. In this case, it's the American taxpayer.
No question about it. We had to, put in over $200 billion back of our taxpayer money into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac just to hold on. Absolutely.
But one of the questions I've got, have we actually done anything to correct the situation that will keep us from being able to end up in the same kind of situation 5 or 10 or 15 years out, other than the fact temporarily we've made it harder for people to buy homes? But once we loosen those standards again, it seems like the same underwriting provisions where they write the loan, it's sold to a person who then sells it to another group of investors who then sell it to another group of investors. There's nothing in there to prevent the situation from changing once we start loosening the underwriting rules again.
Well, I hope it. There's some common sense in it. I'm hoping it'll go back to the middle where, people understand that, what they can't do what they did before. I think right now it's ultra conservative. I think it's going to get to the point where it'll come back to normalcy. I hope that the lenders have learned, and there are not as many lenders, by the way, as there was several years ago. So there are fewer of them, but don't know what to tell you there. I hope that we've learned our lesson. I hope that we have some more common sense about things. And I seriously doubt we'll ever see this 100% stuff, this, no doc loans anymore. That stuff was ridiculous.
Well, interestingly enough, 40% of everyone who is applying today for a residential loan is turned down.
Really?
And I go along with you, Mark, is that the pendulum has now swung tremendously in the opposite direction. So 4 out of every 10 people applying for a mortgage can't get one. Isn't that interesting? And certainly very, very difficult to get conventional financing today. So that is an issue in itself. Also, when we think about these underwriting regulations, who ends up with the loan? I don't feel so terrible about it if a private investor ends up with the loan. That private investor, maybe it was a hedge fund, and a lot of hedge funds went out of business, but those people at least took risk and should have understood the risk they're taking. On the other hand, when loans get set, essentially these loans are sold back to the federal government through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, then we need pretty complex conservative underwriting standards.
Okay. Well, we're at our midpoint here again in this hour. Time is going very quickly. We have some other callers. We'll continue to take as many as we can. Our guests in this part of Focus 580, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. He's on the program once a month. We talk about money management. This time around, we devoted both hours to the topic, and he brought along as a special guest Mark Chakowski. He is a mortgage consultant. He works with Wind Trust Mortgage in Champain. He's been there for been in that business for 18 years. Before that, he was 17 years as a realtor. So we've been talking about some of the common questions that people have about home loans. And then it seems inevitable that we would get into talking about the current financial crisis that we're still going through. Other questions, welcome. We try to take as many people as we can. We need to pause here for just a moment, too, remind people this is our fall fundraising effort. We're looking for the money that will pay for next year's programming. And if you tune in regularly to Focus 580 or Afternoon Magazine or any of the programs we have here, you should know that they're here in large part because of you, because of people like you who support the station with your dollars. And if you've made a pledge, thanks. If not, this would be a great time to do it. Martha Deal, one of our producers, is here in studio with us.
I am indeed. And the last time I checked, we were a little over $5,400 with 54 callers, and that's for today. And I promise that the next time I come in here just before noon, I will have those numbers with me.
Okay.
David Sinnoh was talking about risk. WILL is not a risk. It's a sure bet. But the way it's a sure bet is that your dollars support us and that they keep us going. As David has said, David Inge said to you today, and Jay Pierce said earlier today, our finances have been that we used to traditionally depend upon the university and the state and the federal government have been reduced time and time again over the last 5 years. So that's why we depend more than ever on you. And maybe a short time ago, you were in a place where you couldn't make that $60,000, $120,000 contribution. And now as the stock market starts to go up again, maybe you're seeing the possibility for being able to do that. And in some of those cases, it works out to $5 or $10 a month and is much more possible and doable. Ooh, that was redundant. But please pick up the phone, call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org to make your pledge. And to those of you who have, thank you.
Yeah. Well, we want to continue taking calls here for the time that we have left, about 20, 25 minutes here in this part of Focus 580. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Champagne is our next caller, and this would be line one. Hello.
Thank you. Yes, I'm calling from the perspective of somebody who thankfully has been able to pay off their house and didn't have to worry about that. But I am getting tired of hearing people constantly bash the borrowers for this crisis. I think we need to recognize that there was an awful lot of fraud and predatory lending on the part of the banks. And further, even with the kind of loans that were made, the crisis wouldn't be nearly as bad if the banks hadn't been doubling down on these derivatives that have jacked the problem up way more. And quite frankly, I'm still amazed that there's not a general revolt in the country over the bailout and how that's gone, and especially when you consider that today, Goldman Sachs and other, you know, these big banks like them are essentially borrowing at 0% interest on, you know, the taxpayer and turning around and lending for whatever they can get on that money. And, you know, they're getting fatter and bigger and more powerful and having more influence over the elected officials so that, you know, and it's all being done by fleecing the taxpayers.
Well, I appreciate the comment. You guys, whatever you want to say about that, go ahead.
Well, interestingly enough, when we mentioned Goldman Sachs, Goldman Sachs is one of the few investment banks that is now a full bank that really sort of avoided the mortgage crisis. Very, very smart people. Of course, they were originally an investment bank. They wanted to take deposits, so they then became a bank, and then they availed themselves of government money. So the caller is absolutely correct. When you have government money, which is essentially at very, very low interest rates that you can utilize, and then you can invest that money at higher rates, well, obviously you're going to make a profit. Is that a fair thing? Probably not. So on that sense, I certainly would agree with you. But nonetheless, they were very, very savvy, since we mentioned them, that they were one of the few that avoided this whole crisis.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller for the comments. We'll go on to another caller here, line three. This is somebody on a cell phone, so we want to get right to them. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Question about paying off a home. We paid off our home 3 years ago, and it was a situation where we had originally financed with a local mortgage company, and they were bought out a couple times. The last person that owned our mortgage was Regions Bank. When we paid it off, all we got was a letter saying that our house had been paid off. And when you pay off a car, you at least get a title. I went to the county, and they said that the mortgage company said they sent everything to the county. The county said they don't keep it. They send it back to the mortgage company. I finally got a hold of the main office, and they said they don't keep any of that documentation. Just make sure we keep the letter. Well, we, you know, what happens when you pay off a mortgage that's been transferred to several places? Is there some paperwork we need in the future if we ever sell our home?
Well, there certainly is, and you need to stay on top of this. You should have procured what is called a release of indebtedness or release of mortgage. That is a legal document that gets recorded in the courthouse in the county where your property is located. So, for example, if you're in Champaign County, a release document should have been recorded. So one of the things that you want to check on is perhaps that release was sent to the local courthouse and it was recorded, and then maybe it was sent back to one of these financial institutions. So have you checked to see whether or not a release was recorded?
The county did say that they had received something from the mortgage company that it was paid. They had entered it in their books that it was paid, and then they sent all the paperwork back to the mortgage company.
Okay.
And the mortgage company said they do not keep any of that paperwork.
Okay. Well, it sounds as though that the release of the mortgage was recorded. If it were me, because I'm a detailed person, I would probably go down to the courthouse and have them look that up for you in the book and the page number, which actually shows, yes, indeed, now we have a clear title. The mortgage has been redeemed. It's been paid off. It has indeed been released. Once we know that, then you are free and clear. You've got a free and clear title to alienate or sell that house. So you have complete alienability in that particular piece of real estate. Whether you're ever going to run down that paperwork, well, it doesn't sound very hopeful, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No, but the bottom line is, if the county has recorded it, you should be in great shape.
So you don't actually get like a deed with the description of the property or anything like that once you pay off a mortgage?
Well, typically at the closing, you may have well received the deed just recently after your original closing, because the deed simply shows that the property is titled in your name, subject to certain indebtedness, subject to certain mortgages. So I would think that you would have received the deed already.
We do have something that describes the property, and I'll have to go back and look at that.
That's my guess. My guess is you have a warranty deed sitting in your lockbox or in your paperwork. But do go down to the courthouse and make certain that a release was actually recorded on your property.
All right. Thanks very much.
Okay. All right. Thanks. You know, one thing that I wanted to ask you about a little bit more, and actually Mark sort of touched on this way back at the beginning of the program, you were talking about the credit score. And one of the things that people now for, I don't know how many years, have been advised is that you periodically should check your credit. And the three big credit reporting companies that you mentioned, they're obligated every year to give you free a credit report. Now, what they'll try to do is sell you a more enhanced kind of product. But basically, the basic thing you can... And there's a
website. There's a website. It's called annualcreditreport.com. It's not freecreditreport.com. It's annualcreditreport.com. And you are then entitled, if you go to that site, prove who you are, you can download your credit report. It will not give you a credit score. When the federal government passed these new rules, you get a credit report, which basically tells you everything that you ever wanted to know about your credit. And maybe there's something on there that you didn't even know about, and that's one of the reasons to check it. Typically, what people do is that every 4 months, they go online, and first they'll call up Experian, then they'll call up TransUnion, and then they'll call up a third credit reporting agency. There are three that are listed, so that every 4 months, you can actually download a credit report. Now, as I said, that doesn't give you a score, but for a very few dollars, you can have them instantaneously give you the credit score. And incidentally, when you check your own credit or request your own credit score, it does not reduce your overall credit score. When a financial institution is making a request for your credit score, then it can have a tiny, tiny impact on your credit score.
Well, I guess the thing that I was wondering about is once you get to the point where you know what your credit score is, or maybe if you don't, but you're expecting that, you know, maybe you're thinking sometime in the next year, I am going to apply for funding because I want to buy a house. Are there some things that you can do today and over, say, the next course of the next year that can improve your credit score?
Good question. Yes, you can. One thing, and this is a little tidbit I always use on tell people, is number one is in regards to your credit cards. All your credit cards have limits. Let's say you have a $10,000 credit limit. If you keep your balance below 30%, it will help your credit score. So if you have three credit cards that say $10,000, $10,000, and $10,000, And if you have 3,000, 3,000, and 3,000, you're fine. It's good. But if you have one of them that has 5,000, one of them has 4,000, it hurts you. So the key thing is there, the 30% number. So try to keep your credit card limit, your balances at 30%. That will help your credit score. Simple thing. A lot of people don't know that. It's something you can improve your credit score. Number two is don't close old accounts. If you have any credit cards that you've had for 10 years, you're not using them, don't close them because that's a history of your credit. And they like the history showing that you've had credit and you've been able to pay it on time. Anytime you open any new credit card in the last 12 months, it hurts you until it's been 12 months. Again, that's new credit. They don't know what's going to do. That hurts your credit score. Those are just a couple of things right off the top of the head that can help you.
And also, when you look at your credit score, there is typically a number, 001, for example. If you see lots of 01s, that means paid as agreed. You want to see on your credit report that type of language, that you have paid as agreed. Now, it's okay to have a 30% balance against your credit limit. I prefer to make sure that you pay those off every month because obviously the interest rate that you're paying on those credit cards
right.
is just, well, it's geometric. It's certainly double digits. And when you're sitting in a savings account at 1% and you're paying credit cards at 12 to 15%, pay yourself first, which means pay off your credit cards. That's really great advice. People often will go in and to a department store, get a 20% discount if they will sign up for a credit card. They'll sign up for the credit card. They'll get the 20% discount, get the credit card in the mail, and then cancel the credit card. You've made two mistakes. One is you've essentially gotten the credit card in the first place, which means that you've increased your unsecured credit. And then two, you've canceled it. Right? Don't do that.
All within the first year, and that just hurts you. Now, one thing I think I get a lot of questions on this, and it has something to do with what you're saying. This has to do with inquiries on your credit report, which Dave touched on. Bottom line is, if you go to three different lenders in one day, it's not going to ding you three times. It's going to ding you one time because it's the same type of business. If you were going to look for a car and you went to three places and they pulled up your credit three times, it'll count as one inquiry, not three. A lot of people ask me those questions. Well, I don't want to have you pull up my credit because it's going to ding my credit score. Yes, it will if you know a little bit, but that shouldn't make the difference. If you're at 739 or 741, it might, yes. But
don't go forum shopping.
No.
You don't
exactly.
want to go forum shopping. That
right.
was the point.
Right.
You don't want to go to multiple outlets because that can impact your credit.
And some people do without you knowing it, and that's where you got to be careful too.
Yeah. Well, we got another call here. We're going to get at least one more in Park Ridge. Up in the Chicago area, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Sino's guest, I guess. I'd just be a question more appropriate. I understand the word recourse is in mortgages. I'm not sure if they're in all, that word is in all mortgages. And I wonder if you could have an example of if the word recourse is in your mortgage. And let's say you lose your job or something, have some trouble meeting payments, what could they come after you for?
Okay, in Illinois is a recourse state, which means that when you sign a promissory note and a mortgage and you fail to make your payments, not only can your house be taken away from you, in other words, foreclosed, and you actually can get kicked out of your own home through a foreclosure process, that in addition, when that lender, the holder of that note and mortgage, eventually sell the property, let's say the mortgage was $200,000, and in the final analysis is the lender got it back, sells it for $150,000, there is a deficiency, and that is often called a deficiency judgment of $50,000, the difference between what you promised and what the lender ended up with. And in Illinois, a lender or a holder of that note and mortgage can come after you personally, which means that all of your assets are at risk, your savings accounts, your bank accounts, etc., and could almost force you into bankruptcy. And then you would have certain exemptions like pension funds, like IRAs, certain other exemptions as well. But make no mistake about it, in Illinois, it is a full recourse state. Now, often, however, a lender recognizes that if someone defaults, chasing that person, they're not going to get anything anyway. So as a result, they might take what's called a deed in lieu of foreclosure, where the person who is in the house says, yes, I can't make any payments. I know I'm behind. I'll never catch up. Here, let's forget the foreclosure process. Here's a deed to the house. I'll quit claim my interest in the house back to you, and in consideration, you won't come after me for a deficiency judgment.
Uh-huh.
Now, in contradistinction, let's take California. If you buy a house in California, California is a deed of trust state, and you buy that house with what is called a purchase money first mortgage. So you buy a $750,000 house, which might be a typical price in California. You get a $700,000 mortgage in the old days. You can't make the mortgage payment. Guess what? You can walk out of that house, leave the keys with the lender, and there is no personal liability. All right? So some states are deed of trust states, like California. Some states are deficiency states, like Illinois.
So that's a technical term, deficiency state.
Exactly. So we have what are called deed of trust states and mortgage states.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's an important consideration going forward then.
No question.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we're coming down to the point here where we're getting kind of short on time. We have at least 5-6 minutes left. I don't know if, Dave, you want to just run down the couch potato.
I do. I want to jump in there because Harriet Williamson has been kind enough to post the most recent results on our couch potato portfolio. And recall, basically, we have a series of asset class funds. We can call them index funds. And there all together are essentially 8 of these, and you can access this on the WILL website. We have the S&P 500 representing large companies. We have the small caps, the Russell 2000, for example. We have value indexes. We have international indexes, emerging markets indexes, as well as REIT indexes. And the website will tell you exactly the percentage allocation and the name of each of those mutual funds. Well, here's the bottom line. Through last night's close, our equity portfolio has moved up this year some 32.04%. So if you had a dollar in the portfolio on January 1, you'd have approximately $1.32 at the moment. What's more important is to compare that result to our benchmark, which is the S&P 500. And actually, the S&P has had a wonderful run since January 1, which is up about 24%. So bottom line here is that our portfolio is running about 800 basis points or 8% higher than the S&P. The reason that's important is because now we're back to something that I've always preached, and that is that diversification, at least most of the time, makes sense. It not only reduces the volatility of your portfolio, it actually results in an increased return for your portfolio. And as we know, if you are an international investor this year, an emerging markets investor this year, you have been handsomely rewarded because both of those areas of the global marketplace have outperformed U.S. markets. So 32%, we're not anywhere near back to where we were 2.5 years ago, but at least we're moving in the right direction. Now, we've crossed this mythical area, this 10,000 Dow. What does that really mean? I don't think it means a whole lot other than it's a psychological barrier. Are we going to move up from here? As you know, I don't make predictions. As you know, I am a very long-term investor, and I continue to repeat that over very, very long periods of time, a diversified portfolio of stocks and stock market indexes generally outperform the best fixed income that money can buy. So you never want to take all of your money and put it in one basket. But if you are going to put 20, 30, 40% of your money in equities, this is one way, one means of investing. And again, I caution you, I'm talking long term, not 5 years, not 10 years, not 15 years. I'm talking decades. I want you to think as a legacy investor. So where we go from here? Well, only time will tell. I'm not in the prognostication business, but again, we've got a long way to go just to get back to that mythical 14,000 Dow, which some of us remember from about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if somebody wants to call real quick, we can get in a question here. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455.
I think one of the things that's been driving the stock market, besides just some notion of optimism, is that inflation has stayed pretty damp. It has been dampened down. And if you look at inflation over the last 12 months, even if you don't believe the government statistics, it's really delta neutral or perhaps even a bit negative. That's been positive. Of course, artificially, the government has kept down interest rates. Short-term treasury rates, short-term money market rates, as we all know, practically zero, maybe a half a percent. So we have a lot of money awash in the system again. There's over $3.8 trillion sitting in money market funds today looking for a home. Some of that is moving back into equities, into the stock market, which is driving prices higher. So there are a number of reasons why we're seeing a slow trend up in the stock market. We're seeing, and it doesn't convince me, we're seeing fewer unemployment claims each week. But let's face it, we're talking a 9 to 10% national unemployment rate. That's very, very disturbing. And most economists agree that even with an improvement in the economy, even with an end to this so-called recession, unemployment is going to be a lagging indicator for some time to come. And that is going to be very, very dampening for the economy.
Okay. Let's take a caller here. Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. You know, I've heard this story given over and over again about diversification. The idea of diversification is to reduce your risk by taking things that are negatively correlated with your assets.
Correct.
Now, that leads to a lower rate of return.
No, higher one. Not necessarily. It leads to lower volatility, which means in...
No, it leads to a lower rate of return.
Well...
That's the idea is that you're accepting a lower rate of return in response for insurance. And that insurance is that if your stuff goes down, you have something that is negatively correlated with that goes up. And that... So people try to convince you that somehow that if you diversify, you're going to get a higher rate of return. Well, that flat out is not true.
Well, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. Over long, long periods of time, I would suggest to you that a less volatile portfolio will outperform a more aggressive portfolio.
And that simply isn't true.
Well, it is
okay,
true.
Okay, you get a return on risk. A volatile portfolio in the long run is going to give you bigger rates of return than one that is in, let's say, fixed access. That's the whole idea behind the fact that stocks make more than fixed income. It's because there's a risk associated with them. And if you went to a pure something that had no risk whatsoever, it's going to make a lower rate of return. And I think these things get confused by people on here, and people actually end up believing this. And in the long run, stuff is based on some good analysis of things like 5 years. And they say if you take any 5-year period over X time in the history, that you have gotten a bigger return on the stock market than you would in any fixed asset. That was true until 2000 or 1999. For the last 10 years, it has not been true. But people don't say that. And so, you know, people are going to come on here and sell this stuff as investment advice. It ought to be correct.
Well, I think we have a difference of opinion which we're not going to be able to resolve here on the program.
If I could just take 1 minute. Hey, we have a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is what I would point out. As I have always counseled people, if you're going to be in the stock market, you have to be a long-term investor, a legacy investor, decades, not 5 years. If you're in 5 years, obviously, any other type of investment might outperform the stock market. But I want to go back to this issue of volatility and clear that up. Let's take a simple example. Let's take an example where I invest a dollar, and the first year rate of return in my diversified portfolio is zero. The second year rate of return on my diversified portfolio is zero. My average rate of return is zero, and I still have a dollar. My friend, who was just on the phone, has an aggressive portfolio. He's taking more risk. He has a dollar, and his portfolio goes up 50% in the first year. A volatile, very, very aggressive portfolio. But in the next year, when the stock market goes down, his portfolio goes down 50%. 50% plus, 50% minus, we have the same average return of 0%. How much money does my friend have? Well, his dollar went up to $1.50. He earned 50%. But then he lost 50% of $1.50, and oh my goodness, he has 75 cents. Bottom line is that volatility tremendously impacts portfolios in those inevitable periods of time when stocks go down. The caller is dead wrong about what he said, and I would stand on that to my dying day, and I want to clear that up.
All right. We are at the point we must stop for this time around, with the promise that next month we'll do it again. It'll just be an hour next month, but we'll do it again with our guest, David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. I want to say thanks to him and also to a special guest here, Mark Jakowski, who has been a mortgage consultant now for the past 18 years. Before that was a realtor. He works at Wynn Trust Mortgage in Champaign. Hey, thanks very much for being here, both of you, very much.
Thank you. And Mark, it's just been a pleasure to hear you talk about mortgages. It's been great.